You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome again to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is August 10th, 2025, very early August 10th, 2025. And we're going to deal with something very fundamental today. We've dealt with some of these things before, but always in different ways and with different emphases. The title here is Money and the Antichrist, the Ideology of Jewish Globalism and Its Immutable Laws. Now, a lot of this was inspired from E. Michael Jones' Barren Metal, which was an excellent book on economic history. I've cited it before. But Mikhail Nazarov is always, you know, one of my favorite Russian authors. He's inspired some of that too. You know, it's the case that the regime always acts in secret. I shouldn't say that. They you know, their agenda is often secret. They act behind closed doors most of the time. But they're intellectuals. They don't write in secret. People like Jacques Attali laid out exactly what they wanted to happen, which is what's going on now. There was nothing secret about what they wrote. It's just that these works were fairly obscure. Now, this is not going to be a philosophical discursus on the concept of money. There's one thing that Karl Marx got right, was when he was a young man, when he wrote in his early manuscripts. He really laid it out in a almost a Hegelian way. And I'm not going to improve on that. Now, as I was, you know, this took, as always, these take days of research to get right for, you know, for my standards, you know. And I was looking, and I come across, there are these women out there, they're always women, who have these spells that they're going to sell you so that you could summon mammon. It's very common. You have to have a protection spell because, you know, he's very powerful. They're going to sell you the methods by which you summon this demon. The implication is that he's going to listen to you because you've burned enough rose petals or whatever it is. He's now going to take orders from you. And they have headlines like, make 2017 your year. Make sure you have a balanced budget. Here's a summoning spell. There's no way they could really believe in this stuff. They would not be messing with it otherwise, but they're still messing with it. It's one of the reasons that so many people disappear. But Mammon is a being. He's one of the infernal names. He is also a concept. He is also a mentality. He is not money, but he is that drive, that passionate drive of greed. Now, money is necessary. Pol Pot tried to do away with it. Fidel Castro tried to do away with it. And it never works. You know, societies develop. You need to have a uniform measure of material values for very diverse things, very diverse but necessary things, and various units of measure are used. You know, even the natural products, you know, livestock, measures of grain, leather, or whatever it is, And then they were replaced by more compact and mobile items, as John Locke talks about. Precious stones and even precious metal with the owner's stamp. And the more that occurred, the more that money acquired an abstract form. Now, that then expanded. And then financial structures emerged. You had things like paper receipts, bonds at the financial centers, which had their representatives along world trade routes. And that seemed to develop very quickly. You know, Carthage, the Phoenicians, these are ancient societies. Temple banks minted money. Monarchs minted money as an instrument of power and control over the economy of the place where they ruled. But unlike the natural exchange of the past, all money had to have one obligatory property. It couldn't have anything useful for human life, but it still had to be recognized by everybody as a conventional measure of value. So the heart of money was not a specific value in and of itself, but almost a consensus, a contractual, conventional value. It had to be recognized as such. Now you fast forward to today, and almost all monetary transactions are done in digital form, in the form of, you know, the ultimate level of abstraction. One of the so-called immutable principles of the economy is credit and debt. It's not just, it's the use not only of real material values, but really credit is for those not yet created. You're borrowing from the future for the present. But loans are still issued from virtual funds. So money turns from a measure of value into a commodity in its own right. No matter how hard you tried, money still had a certain demand attached to it, and it had a highly fluctuating value subject to various forms of manipulation, as we know. So money has then been perverted yet again, having been altered from its original purpose, which is exactly what the word perversion means. It doesn't reflect real value. It distorts the value for the benefit of certain powers, but it has the value it has due to the labor of others at an absolute minimum. Now, we live in a world where increasingly the U.S. dollar is not being used as a reserve currency. Everyone in the universe knows that the dollar, whether it be electronic, paper, or whatever, is not backed by gold or any kind of material assets, because it can't be backed by production, because production has been at a standstill for a very long time. Fiat money is okay if the society has a productive base. The U.S. does not. As of right this second, August 10th, 2025, total American debt from the state, from the federal government, is $37 trillion. Which I think, when you say it, you don't fully grasp how large that is. It's about 150% of GDP. That does not include a very similar, almost the same amount at the private sector and local debts. So then you take all of that, you have a debt roughly of $70 trillion. And not including interest. Of course, there's not enough dollars in the world to ever pay that at any given time. So the only thing that can be done is this debt is constantly being restructured, including for the benefit of the American state. You know, Bernie Sanders goes on about how he's going to regulate banks. It's such a Jewish scam. He knows that that's not possible. No, the banks regulate the state, not the other way around. The banks allow the U.S. government to function. So it starts to sound, over time, like a financial pyramid. No one really thinks that there's going to be a limit on debt growth in America. That's why the so-called reliability of the American currency. Let me quote Mikhail Nazarov. You know, I got the idea from him, and here's what he says. My translation here. The only difference from fraudulent pyramid schemes is that the latter sooner or later reach their logical limit due to the exhaustion of cash. While in the USA, the figures of growing debt have no limit. They only designate the difference between the real self-financing of the American superpower and its expenses, covered in a single world financial and economic mechanism at the expense of the rest of humanity. This is the essence of neocolonialism, where the exploitation of the underdeveloped world is carried out not by occupation forces, by the financial stranglehold of an equal market exchange, and the debts of the debtor countries only increase. Well, the U.S. is the ultimate debtor country. And sometimes there is occupation forces, depending on circumstances. The American working class, which the left does not care about, the family farm class, which is largely gone, the middle class, which exists exclusively on debt, that neocolonial idea still exists. There is a global parasitic power. You know, George Soros isn't just a financier. He wrote things. Why people don't read him, I don't know. But let me quote him. To understand why market fundamentalism and American hegemony are closely linked, it is important to realize that global markets benefit the countries at the center of the international market system, especially the U.S. Financial markets suck up the costs of the savings and profits created in the world, pump them into the center, then send them back to the periphery, either directly through financial instruments like stocks and bonds, or indirectly through transnational corporations. The center is a provider of financial and other services, from information, from higher education to entertainment, and it's a base for most transnational corporations. It therefore receives a lion's share of all income. The dollar is the main reserve currency, and all existing international financial institutions are influenced by the U.S. and other countries at the center of the international market system. They are the ones who determine policy. Now, that was written some time ago. But George Soros is one of these people that showed how leftists, as we talked about in the Jewish question, Karl Marx, that capitalism, the free market, and its connection with the Jews is extremely revolutionary. Outside of the USA, especially in the Third World, the parasitic nature of the American economy is understood, but they're forced to put up with it. Any global collapse would be a collapse of their own system. Those that are at least currently incapable of self-sufficient life. Even China, to invest its income in buying American debt, although they keep releasing it, which is a measure of control. So, what Soros is saying here is that the money power becomes, for lack of a better word, the priest that offers a sacrifice. The entire global socio-political, cultural, and ideological system of society beyond American borders. So, during the so-called Cold War, there was an attempt after World War II to build somewhat of an autarkic system, that is to say, a self-sufficient system. Now, Tsarist Russia could have easily done that, because the Soviets never even got close to the old Russian level of production and agriculturally or anything else. But even under the Soviet system, it was vaguely possible. Both natural resources and a high level of scientific technology allowed it through Soviet industry, was created on the basis of, I mean, we know that the Soviet industry was based on the West. It was financed by the West. Copied by carbon copies of Western models. They were educated in Western universities, but still, by the time we're talking about, they had their own cadre of scientists. Now, the system, of course, failed in competition with the West, not so much for economic reasons, but for ideological ones. They were the basis of its economic inefficiency, strangulation of personal economic initiative. Somehow the Soviets always equated private enterprise with a crime, forced equalization, the direction of a huge part of the resources to ideologically conditioned goals like foreign aid, huge amounts of foreign aid to Marxist regimes throughout the Third World, not to mention the massive human sacrifices in the Gulag camps, which were a big part of the Soviet economy. They were, at any given moment, 25 to 30% of the productive capacity of the Soviet economy was in the Gulag. But at the same time, they demanded hard work and sacrifice based on very little. No one really believed, though, in the bright future. Certainly, as the 50s, 60s, 70s, no one believed it anymore. The Marxist idea, to put in very simple freshman philosophy course terms, being determines consciousness. The level of development of productive forces, the base, agriculture, heavy industry, determines the ideology, the culture of the people, the superstructure, which always is refuted in the very functioning of Marxism, certainly in the USSR. It was a Marxist superstructure that took upon itself to determine the base of its economic policy. The Communist Party, guided not by production or economic goals, but by ideological ones, is what drove it into the ground. It was Ivan Kudenko in the 1960s. Killed him. They had him murdered for some reason, but he said, "We don't need every kind of efficiency, only socialist efficiency." He was a major figure in accounting. But ideology was the most important. But ideology was very vague in the 1960s. The superstructure was a lie, and it had a huge negative impact on society. It doomed it to economic failure and a constant war against its own people. Counter-revolution was expressed in things like doublethink. Now, Solzhenitsyn talks about it all the time. Jokes. Absenteeism. Sometimes even alcoholism. And as time went on, in the 1970s, a very large shadow economy. Now, the Soviet system may have been reformed along the Chinese model. Or even the Belarusian model. Replacing the any kind of Marxist ideology with a healthy national one. The Chinese, the socialism with Chinese characteristics. That's their national socialism. But there was no one in their party nomenclatura, the middle management, with a sense of inferiority towards the West, would ever print it, not to mention the West itself. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, was plundered by that very same group of people, the Jewish mafia and their Western professors. They were the very same people, once privatization was announced, who were then able to grab up all the shares and create what we now know as oligarchy. Now, there is a German economist named Friedrich Romek. Wrote a paper, I don't have a date for it, called The Conservative Economics Versus the Market Economy. You translate something from Russian, conservative means a lot more than it means in America. It could mean royalist, could mean feudal, could mean agrarian, all that stuff. Let me quote from him here. We're talking about the nature of the market economy. And I don't like using the word, I don't like using words like the oil market, because there is no such thing. Prices are set by the major firms. Various political events are used as pretexts. But anyway, here's what he says initially. The market economy is a child of liberalism. Liberalism is a child of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment the separation of man from God, and finally, from any authority, with an appeal to individual human reason that's considered mature. The independent human mind, which no longer understands itself as a manifestation of logos, must find its principle within itself in order to be able to answer the question of what is reasonable. But of course, we call that rationalism. What does that come down to? For rationalism, what is reasonable is ultimately only that which creates pleasure, or something that is good, the satisfaction of needs, profit, welfare. And of course, it's opposite, the displeasure, misuse, uselessness, nuisance, cost, pain. The principle of reason that determines action is, according to the rationalist view, the economic calculation of the pleasure and pain, utility and disutility, use and expenditure, income and cost conception. So far as man acts rationally, only then does he act as an enlightened man, as a rational animal. All his poetry, his aspirations, everything he does are aimed solely at obtaining pleasure, as well as acquiring external wealth and power. These are the two means of fulfilling any desire. That's what drives the so-called market economy. The thirst for profit and the desire for power. Now, of course, the powerful, or even the not so powerful, their desire for pleasure, wealth, profit, will collide with similar desires from those around them, his competition. The market, thus, is a place of competition. Never allow yourself to underestimate what Darwinism did to the capitalist mentality. Now, competition predated Darwin. Darwin was heavily influenced by that, by Malthus in particular. But the market economy is usually equated with the competitive economy. So, in any competition, it's about selecting the best, according to basic rules or standards. The most capable should receive whatever rewards are available. On that idea, competition, really the only justification for capitalism is competition. The service or function attributed to the market economy, the optimal solution here, is the main problem of any national economy, the allocation of limited resources. The only justification for capitalism at all is competition. In other words, resources are transferred to the best owner, those who can use it the best, the most capable companies, the buyers with the most purchasing power, places with the highest incomes, you know, a capital and country with the highest real interest rate. But only on one condition. The selection of the best and the migration of resources must not be violated. Competition, therefore, can't be distorted. Nothing could intervene here. The market must be, quote-unquote, free. The claim, of course, is that when, and this is strictly an ideal circumstance, the market and competition are left to themselves, they perform a self-regulation. This is connected to liberalism itself. It's only necessary to specify the rules of the game, the norms according to which competition must be conducted, as it performs its selection function. But like anything else, there's winners and losers. In economics, and you see this in Darwinism, this has fatal consequences for the loser. The goal of competition is selection. The loser should not have a chance at the market. He's forced out. And not just forced out, but his assets are absorbed by the victor. So it's always a predatory competition. A fight for market shares and control over markets and access to markets. So ultimately, competition wants to cancel itself. It strives for monopoly. Competition is a struggle for monopoly, for preferential positions, the ability to charge rents. Yet, we look at post-industrial society as a world of monopolies. Cartel agreements. But wars, too, are a form of competition. They're decided by strategy, equipment, you know, morale, whatever it is. Now you have something called the social market economy, something along the lines of neoclassicism. The surprising thing is, and we have to actually agree with K.V. Rothschild here, there is not a single micro or macroeconomic class, neoclassical basic theorem that would correspond to modern epistemological statements, either logically or empirically. It could pass any logical test. There's not one. There's not any of their laws, so-called, can never be empirically proven. So what you have today is just applied mathematics. The law of supply and demand is just a tautology. Supply and demand curves, the intersection of which price can be found, are purely ideal considerations. Or what is competition? Adam Smith created his own version of the state of nature. And that was something called perfect competition. It was a tiny group, buyers and sellers, who knew each other. They knew everything there was to know about not only the products, but each other. And that was the foundation for competition for Adam Smith. Now, of course, that's perfection. But to use that to justify present post-industrial economic practice is absurd. Darwin makes a lot more sense. The law of supply and demand is a tautology. Those curves exist only in ideal worlds. They end up dividing markets into sub-markets and elementary markets until it evaporates altogether. You only have behaviors of individual customers and their relationships. So some 30 years ago, neoclassical methods fell apart because they didn't want to use the word markets anymore. Only relationships. Now, I've made the statement that the postmodern, post-industrial oligarchy that we live under today functions not so much by competition. Competition does function at the lower levels. That's true. It does. It can have very positive outcomes. I think it's more rare than we realize, but it does exist at the local levels. You know, you have three pizza shops in one town, you know, that kind of thing. But to be a part of the oligarchy, it isn't so much efficiency. Or I should put it this way, efficiency is defined as being able to privatize profits and externalize costs. That's what is considered successful. And that's another reason why the word market doesn't make any sense anymore. Unemployment was never solved by any capitalist model. You know, the marginal efficiency of capital, propensity to consume, propensity to liquidity, all this stuff, these were buzzwords. If you go to my Patreon and my paper on oligarchy, the nature of oligarchy as the foundation of political economy, I did a lecture on that too a couple years ago, I add a lot more detail to that. Unemployment can't be controlled, so in 2025, they simply lie about it. But even things like, you know, Reaganite small government, which never occurred, I mean, privatization, deregulation, that did occur, still didn't solve the problem of unemployment over time. But it would be possible to shift the blame to predecessors in the political department. Market economy, in other words, is an ideology. It's a way of thought rather than something that's real. Remember, the same thing occurred when, you know, in the early 90s in the Soviet Union. That was considered a market economy. All it was very well-placed, very powerful Jews using their already powerful positions within the shadow economy, in the state, wherever, buying up shares, and then really liquidating them, which is why you had something along the lines of 80% the productive capacity of the old Soviet Union liquidated by 1995 or 1997. Still came under some conception of the free market. It's a disguise. You cover up positions of power, the conquest, the struggle for power, the maintenance of power. It's a way to divert attention to how modern industrial society actually functions, how or by whom, for whose benefit it is motivated and controlled. I've used the example before, but there is no oil market. Let's say there is Iran seals the Straits of Hormuz, right? Which is a big slogan. People like talking about that. It makes them sound smart. They've never really heard of it, but they know it's important. Well, the U.S., as far as U.S. and Canada, it doesn't matter. We don't get any oil from over there. However, it will be treated as a pretext, an excuse for raising prices. Well, look what the Iranians are doing, you know. That same economist, Romick, says the following. The characteristic feature of this development of modern industrial society is a complete fusion of large-scale industry, business, armaments, research, technology, mass production, consumption, entertainment, communication, manipulation, state bureaucracy, and politics. The entire system of training and education for the production factor of man is aimed at the needs of large-scale industry. The state supports large-scale research, which now has become an industry. Electronics, space shuttles, satellite communications, atomic, whatever. All of these are the social costs of private enterprise. Industrial society serves not the needs of, you know, the nation, but its own needs. Its rationality manifests itself in the highest forms of its own destruction, wastefulness, and, of course, alienation. Now, I said that many times long before I heard of this guy. The complete fusion of that list, industry, business, armaments, research, technology, public consumption, entertainment, that's, you know, taken together. The rulers of those fields are the regime, and they get together in Bohemian Grove and Bilderberg. However, industry isn't a huge part of it, at least as far as domestic American concerns are. I mean, industrial capital is owned by certain Americans that, you know, around the globe. But you still have that modern anti-trinity, science, technology, and industry. Working together and synthesizing together. 60 years ago, it was actually Pope Pius XI. And when I first came across this as a young man, I was still Catholic. And let me quote him real fast here. This is a fundamental error of individualistic economics, from which all the particular errors originate. An oblivion or misunderstanding of the moral nature of economics. Believe that state power has nothing to do with economics except to leave it freely and unhindered to itself. On the market, that is to say, under conditions of free competition, having it at its regulating principle. But free competition, although justified and certainly useful, provided that it's maintained within certain limits, certainly cannot govern economic life, a truth which is a result of its application and practice, as more it's been demonstrated. It's obvious that not only is wealth concentrated in our time, but also enormous power and despotic economic dictatorships are consolidated in the hands of a few. This dictatorship is exercised violently by those who own and control money completely, who have an unlimited disposal of credit and determine its distribution at will. They determine regulate the flow, so to speak, of the lifeblood by which whole economic systems function and hold the soul of economic life so firmly in their hands that no one can breathe against their will. You know, as a Roman Catholic, I think it was early grad school, I came across that for the first time in the early 90s. And I realized that, oh my God, you know, being a conservative, you don't have to support the free market anymore. And the free market was, you know, when I was a young man in college, I thought this is what a conservative was, you know. Now, in the Russian case, it's far worse because you can't simply be imposed on a society. Because you already have people in power there who, once it's imposed, then use their positions and leverage their positions to take it all. and claim it's a result of competition. And that's where the Jewish oligarchs came from. So that concentration of power, the regime, it's a natural result of the principle of this unbridled freedom of the passions to be found in things like competition, the rule of Charles Darwin. Only the strongest survive. And who are the strongest? Quite often the most cruel and unprincipled. Money is owned. It's both a factor in its owner's freedom and a factor of his powerful influence on society. But that could have different meanings. I mean, you know, one of our people with money, a pious believer, will try to use his wealth to encourage good in the world by giving it to me. A vicious and greedy atheist will use his money for something selfish, satisfy his lusts. Not to mention, will try to use his financial power to transform society into one that's more favorable to his selfish lusts. The nature of the revolution, which we're still dealing with in the 1960s in America, the sexual revolution, the world financial power behaves in exactly the same way, for which the role of money has long been not just been economic and political, but also ideological. The prominent banker Jacques Attali, who, by the way, I've quoted him before. He is still alive. He's about 135 years old. I had no idea. I thought he was died years ago. And he's one of the guys that hasn't kept the agenda of the regime secret. He's a Jew, of course, and he talks about his people quite often. He talks about that after the First World War, Jewish bankers in different European countries, they had their own financial interests, in their own countries that they lived in. Although they were united in one thing, American Jews enter into an agreement with all others to consider Tsarist Russia as the only country against which war must be waged. And that goes back to Karl Marx's hatred of the Tsar, in his writings on the Crimean War. Prime Minister Lloyd George said there's a feeling of joy when the Russian Tsar was overthrown. And he said, the British government is confident that these events begin a new era in the history of the world, being the first victory of the principles for which we started the war. Loud cries of approval were heard from all places. The English newspaper, Daily News, described the February Revolution as the greatest of all the victories won by the Allies thus far. The revolution is incomparably more important than any victory at the front. The Russian writer, Vladimir Kratunov, still talking about the phenomenon of new Russian money, mostly Jewish, only as an internal Russian phenomenon. He says, a certain threat both to the socio-political structure of the state and the spiritual culture of Russia, the origins of the new Russian mentality in all likelihood should be considered as a particular result of the interaction of two cultural traditions, the transfer of total Western liberalism to Russian soil in the 90s, with its maximalism and violence, of course the most important role in the formation of the value system of the newly minted Russian millionaires was also played by the ugly Soviet reality, to accustom a significant part of society to a parasitic way of life. Proper analysis, the origins and assessments of the phenomenon of new Russians as an element of Russian subculture would help to make a contribution to an understanding of the socio-cultural situation in modern Russia. Now there he's talking about in the 1990s, where you had Soviet atheism mixing with Western liberalism, the worst possible circumstances. Jewish author Lev Rezikovsky wrote an article, Jewish Happiness. And it can also be translated as luck sometimes. Jewish Happiness. He's proud of the fact that in Russia in the 1990s, there was a democratic capitalist revolution. The Jewish and near-Jewish intelligentsia was one of the main bearers of Western liberal ideology in Russia and became the ideologists of this revolution. Jews have a greater specific weight in Russian politics and business than in business of any other Christian country. Calling it a Christian country is pushing it a little bit, but you see his point. You had the February Revolution overthrew the Tsar, the October Revolution that brought the Bolsheviks to power, and of course, immediately started the Civil War. But then, you had the revolution of the late 80s, early 90s. That very phrase, Jewish happiness, it's come up in this show before. It was also the name of a prominent Jewish silent movie in 1925, romanticizing poor Jews in the Pale of Settlement, trying to get out of it like a ghetto, trying to better himself and failing, despite maintaining a very positive attitude and et cetera. It was a romanticization of Jewish life, and of course it's nonsense. Anyway, Atali. He is one of the, if not the, main ideologists of the New World Order. And of course we now have the Great Reset. Although given his age, at 340 years old, you know, how active he is, I don't know. But he was aware that the New World Order has shifted to the Great Reset. And he and other well-known Jewish authors explained the phenomenon that the Jews, even from ancient times, took into their hands their world trade and money, the material blood of human economic activity. He also notes a Jewish sense, thanks to which, from the very beginning of trade, even before the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, he says, quote, Jewish communities settled along the lines of monetary power. There arose an almost absolute but completely unintentional thousand-year dominance of the Jews in international finance. He goes on to talk about the fact that Jews also knew when to get out of something. Something happened in the late 60s, early 70s in the USSR, where the Jews pulled out. Israeli victories in the war, Soviet anti-Zionism, the fact that the investments were not returning the profit that they used to, it was starting to be okay. Of course, the U.S. was surging ahead in light industry, you know, personal computing and everything, that it was time to leave. Atali also says, and I've mentioned this before too, that Jews have a sense. They know when something is developing somewhere else. Things are coming to an end here. We need to pack up and move there where things are developing. But the editor of the Jewish Encyclopedia, even he says, the flourishing of Jewish dominance in the financial world, going back centuries, the 12th century, he links it to the church's ban on Christians engaging in usury. By the 13th century, the majority of Jews in Catholic countries depended on this most despised occupation. Well, I mentioned Vladimir Kortunov before, and he writes in his book, The Philosophy of Money, he says this, capitalism could never have transformed from a mode of production, from a socio-political system into a global worldview, if it had not been in tune with Western mentality, if it had not had a solid foundation within the system of values offered by to humanity by the New Age. From my point of view, such a foundation was the fundamental orientation of Western European culture towards rationalism. In this sense, capitalism as a socio-political system created only the optimal conditions for the implementation of a rationalistic worldview and rationalistic philosophy. The fundamental orientation of the West towards this worldview became obvious much earlier, at the dawn of the New Age. In the Age of Enlightenment, it evolved into a quote, so-called universal system of values. Now, in addition to that, capitalism had another, more spiritual side to it, the Reformation. You know, the Roman Empire at its height had a tremendous scientific establishment. They were living, you know, the average age, you know, lifespan was, you know, 75 years, whatever it is, just like it is now. its roads were far better than the roads that are created now, its geometry, etc. But it didn't move in the development of industry. It didn't create cell phones or video games. Why? Why only much later? Well, it's not merely the Reformation, but the Jewish role in the Reformation. Jews talk about this quite often. The Reformation took place under the influence of Judaism. Max Weber is forced to admit it. The New York rabbi, Lewis Newman, published quite a bit on this. He said, almost all the reformers of Christianity had at least one Jewish friend or teacher. All the most important movements of the Reformation had their origins turned to the word of the Jewish Bible. Now, if he means the Old Testament there, he's being dishonest. He's talking about the Jewish mentality. The mix of Protestantism and Judaism gave rise to both the modern and postmodern systems, this unprecedented economic system casting off all moral prohibitions. The Jewish religious understanding of wealth as God's election was adopted by some of the more extreme Protestant sects. The Puritans, for example, and the Calvinists. I don't want to simplify it too much. The predestination, the denial of free will. But the Age of Enlightenment was unthinkable without Jewish influence. Through many sources, one of which is Freemasonry, which was the union of Protestant churches with Judaism, the bourgeois Masonic anti-monarchist revolutions, which gave full emancipation to the Jews, which meant their total domination of society, transformed their financial dominance into political dominance. Russia's famous Philo Semite, but it's still a genius author, 19th century, Vladimir Solovyov. He said, Judaism managed to occupy a dominant position in the most advanced nations, and their finances and the greater part of the periodical press are in the hands of the Jews, directly or indirectly. The main interest in modern Europe is money, and Jews are masters of the money business, therefore, they're the masters of modern Europe. And Jacques Attali, you can't get any more dominant than he is. Yeah, there are no secrets here. Attali says that the Jewish financiers that came into existence were, and I'm going to quote him here, powers above power. Most of the time they were hidden, but occasionally they became visible, like the Rothschilds, the 19th century, who came to finance most governments. They organized themselves to a strange aristocracy, a kind of strict order, with merciless moral laws and predatory rituals. Which is a serious statement, and that includes inbreeding. But even the Jewish neoconservatives, Hannah Arendt, it's like a rite of passage in political science grad school. You have to read Hannah Arendt on totalitarianism. And she was personally acquainted with the Rothschilds, by the way. Here's how she characterizes the emerging global banking network. Transformation of the Rothschilds into international bankers and the rise of all the other Jewish banking houses changed the entire structure of Jewish state business. This gave a new incentive for the unification of the Jews as a group, an international group at that. For non-Jews, the name Rothschild became a symbol of the international character of the Jews in a world of nations. Jewish banking capital became international, united through intermarriage, and real international caste arose. This isolation and independence strengthened their sense of strength and pride. Hannah Arendt, of course, is a Jew. A few weeks ago, we spoke of Karl Marx's on the Jewish question in 1844. He, around that time, he hated the fact that certain Western bankers were going to profit from loans given to Russia, which he absolutely despised during the Crimean War. And, of course, most of these guys were media, you know, working for the major media. And he published an editorial in the New York Daily Tribune. And he cited huge lists of related Jewish clans that controlled world finance. In his 1844 on the Jewish question, he considered Jewry to be the creator of capitalism and proclaiming a struggle against it. He asserted, and I don't know if I said this the last time, I don't think I did, but Marx says, thus we find in Jewry a general modern antisocial element, which, as a result of historical development in which the Jews took an assiduous part in the negative way, was brought to the modern heights, which is necessarily resolved. The emancipation of the Jews, in its final meaning, the emancipation of humanity from Judaism. The Jew has already emancipated himself in the Jewish way. He has emancipated himself not only by appropriating monetary power, but also by the fact that through him, without him, money has become a world power, and the practical spirit of Judaism has become the practical spirit of the Christian nations. Now, yes, I've said that in the past, but for Karl Marx to say this, even as a young man, is of tremendous significance. This stuff isn't hidden. But Nazarov also brings up Werner Sombart, as I have. Jews in Economic Life from 1911. Talking about the USA. How money functions here. The Jews, expelled from Europe, played an outstanding, if not decisive, role in the creation of the USA with overt Jewish Masonic state symbols. And here's what he says about the Federal Reserve in its, this is 1911, so in its early, or very early stages. He said, a careful examination of Weber's arguments revealed that all those elements of Puritan dogma which actually had an influence on the formation of the capitalist spirit were borrowed from the circle of ideas of the Jewish religion. The United States of America received its economic formation mainly under the influence of Jewish elements. The U.S. in general owes its existence to the Jews. It is only thanks to the presence of Jewish elements that they are what we know them as. For what we now call Americanism in its main features is nothing other than a crystallized Jewish spirit. I have demonstrated with complete clarity that economic life of our time is increasingly subject to Jewish influence. Without them, we would never have reached the culmination of human culture, that is to say, modern capitalism. So this was, you know, right before the Federal Reserve. Obviously, the people who control money have a massive influence on the spiritual state of humanity, their hierarchy of values. What made the Western world move to industry and liberalism comes from the Jewish element, which did not exist before. So to speak, maybe you could say, like, Jews became the yeast of capitalism, the world financial power. Because only Judaism absolutizes monetary values. They don't believe in the immortality of the soul. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that, by the way, on page 29, volume 4. All their values are found on earth. And more than other peoples, they rush to the process of wealth and usury. This was a reason for their dominance of the Jews in world trade, even before Christ. Since they settled around world along trade routes, in greater numbers, were in Palestine, the word Jew and usurer became synonyms. And many peoples of antiquity, in the Middle Ages. And it's proudly acknowledged by many Jewish authors. Again, Attali wrote in his 2002 book, Jews, Peace, and Money. Here's how he explains it. God asked Abraham to be rich so he could serve him. Isaac and Jacob confirmed the necessity of enriching oneself in order to please God. God blesses Isaac's wealth and allows him to buy the birthright of his brother Esau. This is proof that everything has a material value. Even in the form of lentil soup, money is a machine that transforms the sacred into the secular, liberates from coercion, channels violence, organizes solidarity, helps to resist the demands of non-Jews, is a wonderful means of serving God. The Jewish people made money a unique and universal element, an instrument of exchange, just as they made their God a unique and universal instrument of superiority. In this cruel world, ruled by force, money gradually turns out to be the highest form of organization of human relations, allowing all conflicts, including religious ones, to be resolved without violence. The authors of the Talmud were themselves mostly traders, experts in economics. So the things that people go to prison for in the EU, but saying, here you have the dominant academic and bureaucrat writer in the EU, Attali, fully saying it's true. Now, what wealth meant in the time of Abraham has no bearing on what it means now. Nor does Atali or anyone else, any other Jew, believe in God. At a minimum, it came with tremendous obligations. But Vladimir Soloviev also wrote, in that same vein, he said, the Jews are attached to money not at all for the sake of its material benefit, but because they now find in it the main instrument for the triumph of the glory of Israel. In their view, the triumph of God's work on earth. Well, they are gods on earth. So it's about their taking over. It's about their cohesion and their ability to dominate others. Well, I've gone on too far. I'm at an hour now. I'm going to stop here. And I'm going to continue this next week. I know there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot to uncover. There's so much work here. I've gone all over the place, but it's extremely, extremely important. We haven't even gotten to the Antichrist or anything else. So this will be a two-part a lecture. And but keep in mind, people like Atali didn't write in secret. Their stuff was printed by major university presses, saying the same things that we say all the time. We're called conspiracy theorists and all kinds of names. And here, you know, Jewish elites are writing about it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll finish this up next week. Bye-bye.